Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are the safeguards in the criminal justice system strong enough to ensure innocent people do not go to death row? A man named Cameron Todd Willingham was convicted of the arson murders of his three young children in Corsicana in 1992. But neither his trial nor even his execution in 2004 managed to put some people's questions to rest regarding whether the Willingham children in fact died by accident. And some scientific fire investigators who had access to the evidence insist Willingham was not guilty. A joint report released this summer by the Washington Post and the Marshall Project raises new questions about another aspect of the case against Willingham, the testimony of a jailhouse companion. Prison informant Johnny Webb now says prosecutor John Jackson promised to stop pursuing charges against Webb if he would testify that Willingham had confessed to killing his children. Now the Texas State Bar is reviewing those allegations against Jackson, and the PBS series Frontline has updated its documentary on the case to include the latest developments. Producer Jesse Dieter directed Death by Fire 2. It airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. And Jesse, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
The original documentary aired 6 years after Willingham's execution. Can you talk about why this case has lingered in the public consciousness as such a grave example of possible miscarriage of justice?
I think it's because this is the first, as I learned about this case through a New Yorker piece done by David Grant in 2009. And I think that what compelled him about the story is kind of the same thing that's the reason it's not died, as it were, which is this is the first case, if true, in our time, in American time, in this modern time, of an innocent man, a provably innocent man. One doesn't have to prove one, a provably not guilty man being executed. And that means a lot. It means a lot symbolically. Even though Willingham is no longer with us, it has a lot of import if you value our criminal justice system.
For people who weren't living in this area in 1991, remind us of the facts of the case. How did friends and neighbors describe the family, first of all, before the night of the fire?
Well, that's kind of one of the key elements in the case, is that Willingham was not beloved by the town. He was an outsider. He came from Oklahoma. He was poor. He and his wife were poor. And he was kind of seen as a ne'er-do-well at best. He was kind of a petty criminal. There were reports that he didn't treat his wife well. They had three young children together, but they were kind of scrapping by in kind of the poor part of town, and people didn't like him. And so when this fire happened right before Christmas in this very small, very close-knit community, and right after the fire, and even during the fire, there were accounts that Willingham didn't act right. In the parlance of the townspeople, there were reports that he did not go back in to rescue his children, which is true. He did not, although he initially said he did. There were rumors of him rescuing his things and trying to move his car out of the way. There were reports of him, because they were so poor, he and his wife, the townspeople, had a fundraiser at a local bar to raise money for the funeral of these poor children. And Willingham, again, was said not to act how the townspeople thought he should act after his three children had been killed. He drank a lot, I believe, and probably was seen to joke and smile. And so he was not beloved before he went to trial. And then you had the two main pillars of the prosecution's case, the two real things that convicted Willingham, other than the fact that people didn't like him, were, one, a man named Vasquez. Two fire investigators got on the stand and said, this is arson, and this is what happened. There was an accelerant, and they went on to detail why they thought this was arson, a set fire rather than simply an accident. And then two was, so if you have arson and a crime, then you have to have a perpetrator, right? So then you have the jailhouse snitch, Johnny Webb, who gets on the stand and says, Willingham told me he did it. He confessed. So those things were really strong. And once you had those, in addition to the testimony of people saying they, you know, he didn't treat his wife correctly, et cetera, you really had the case kind of sealed against him really before it began.
And to be clear, when people said, excuse me for interrupting, when they said he didn't treat his wife correctly, he had been, police had been called out for domestic violence case reports on multiple occasions to the home.
That's true. And then I interviewed people, I interviewed people on all sides. And so, of course, his friends and family say, yes, well, there were bite marks on his arms. Hmm. And she kind of gave as good as she got, which I am inclined from my reporting to believe, actually.
Witnesses said that Willingham didn't go back into the house to try to grab his children, which is something that I think a lot of parents blanch at the thought of. Can you talk about how Willingham would explain that?
Well, one of the problems is Willingham was young and scared and dumb, right? And so the story he told was that he initially told police investigators he did try to go back in and save his children. Unfortunately, none of the witnesses corroborated that. And he later admits to a really good friend of his and Melissa Gilbert, who is another good friend of his, he admits that he feels terrible. He did not go back in and try to save his children. But at the time, you know, he couldn't admit it, and he didn't admit it. He lied about it.
And he essentially he would say he was guilty, not of arson, but he was guilty of being a coward in the situation.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what he says. That's what he says his crime was being a coward. And then he also says, but, you know, you're facing fire and who knows, you don't know how you're going to respond in that situation, which I think may also be true, you know, that we don't know, happily, most of us.
And where was his wife the night of the fire?
She was working. Mm-hmm. She was working. She was at work and she came home. She came home to this. And his wife is kind of an interesting character. And she's there's nobody without a story in this story, you know.
Initially, at least, she stood with him through the allegations.
She did. Stacy is a very interesting character. And Stacy, actually, years and years and years later, she would not go see. She never once went to see Willingham, her husband, in prison, even though she claimed for years and years that he may beat me, but he was never mean to the children. He would never do that. I don't believe that. She never once believed that her husband had done this. And then just before the execution, she supposedly tells her brother, in the one time she visits her husband, her then ex-husband, before he's executed, she says that he confessed that he killed their children to her right before his execution. And at that time, she did not go public with that, but her brother did. And so that kind of was one of the reasons that Governor Perry did not allow the stay of execution, which the defense team was requesting, because by that point the forensic evidence had been disproven and they were trying to get that taken into consideration. But it was, you know, it was kind of too late. And one of the reasons it was too late, I think, is because there was this new evidence, if you will, that Stacy changed her mind. The wife had changed her mind, and now she believed that, and now she said that her husband confessed to her, even though he never, ever publicly said that.
And for the governor to take that evidence into consideration, it's not sort of held to the same standard that it would be had she given that testimony in court.
Yeah, no, I don't believe so. And the problem is, I mean, the reason that our recent reporting on the testimony of the jailhouse snitch is important is that if they didn't listen to this man, Bill Price, who was kind of the next person, the person advising Perry about this case, has said this year in a testimony, he said, if I had known some of the paperwork around what some of the documents now show about promises made and things that were concessions that were granted to Johnny Webb that were never made public and were never certainly given to Willingham's defense team, I would have had to have demanded a stay of execution to at least examine this new evidence. And so that, at the bare minimum, would have definitely counterbalanced anything that Stacey said.
My guest is Jesse Dieter, producer and director of the Frontline documentary Death by Fire 2, which airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to be part of this conversation about the case of Cameron Todd Willingham, who was executed for the murders of his three very young children, you can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with producer and director Jesse Dieter. She's behind the Frontline documentary Death by Fire 2 that will air tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. It revisits the case of Cameron Todd Willingham, a Corsicana father who was put to death in 2004 for what was called the arson murder of his three very young children. Since that time, many people, including scientific arson investigators, have questioned whether the fire that killed the children was deliberately set. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. All right, Jesse, arson investigators originally in Corsicana identified 20 things that pointed from their perspective to this being a fire that was deliberately set. Can you tell us about some of the most damning from the perspective of the Willingham defense case?
Sure. They had things like crazed glass was seen as an indicator of arson. They had things like patches on the floor that they were sure were evidence of a liquid accelerant having been poured. However, when the patches were actually tested, there was no evidence of a liquid accelerant. They used to see certain fire patterns as evidence that the fire was set from the way they burned, but those have been since proven to have nothing to do with arson whatsoever. And then they really do walk into fires and say things like they sense that they were arson. It was kind of this mystical science, almost like an alchemy at the time, and to the point that in the 90s, and there were regulations that were passed that said, okay, this isn't science. We need to reinvestigate the science of fire and investigation. And there have been people doing some very good work. Paul Bieber has an arson investigation project. Very specifically, the Innocence Project is starting to work on arson. There's a lot of work around arson investigation right now. I think that's exciting because things are changing. And Texas, to their credit, is one of the leaders. The state of Texas has realized that there have been some pretty significant mistakes made there, too. And so they're now kind of helping lead the charge on that. So I'm pleased about that.
Let's listen here to an arson investigator from Corsicana who I think was connected with this case, named Douglas Fogg, and hear his perspective.
The state of Texas executed a man for a crime that they couldn't prove was really a crime. And the evidence says this is an accidental fire. And if it was an accidental fire, it doesn't matter how many posters of Iron Maiden Cameron Todd Willingham had on his wall, or Led Zeppelin, or whether he liked to play darts or drink beer, or whether he smacked his wife around. It only matters that the fire was not really a set fire.
That was, in fact, John Lentini, excuse the error, and that was a later investigator who was brought in after using some of the more modern scientific techniques. And Lentini, Jesse Dieter, is convinced that this fire was not deliberately set.
Correct, and he's not the only one. I'll just say what's interesting about you having identified that remark as Doug Fogg's is Doug Fogg was one of the initial fire investigators. And Doug Fogg, I actually called him last month, and I said, you know, Mr. Fogg, we haven't spoken since 2010. And he already had, at that time had been aware of Lentini's opinion and Gerald Hurst's initial opinion. And then there was the Beiler report, which was actually commissioned out of Texas that was commissioned that everybody all knew arson investigation specialists. Now agree that that fire, there's no evidence that it was a set fire. However, Doug Fogg, to this day, believes that it was a set fire. So that's what's interesting about that. But yes, now people, the specialists in the field looking at all of that evidence now agree that there was no evidence of a set fire. And there's another case that's very similar. There's a parallel case, the case of Mr. Willis, an man convicted on almost the identical set of facts, in quotes, for a fire, a murder fire at the time, who was freed. And I did interview him as well, and Ernest Willis. And unfortunately, that it was one of those things that wound up on the cutting room floor because we didn't have time for it in the film. But there is evidence of a free man walking free on the same evidence.
Well, we do have that sound of Doug Fogg, so we can sort of get an idea of his mindset on all this.
I don't care how many degrees you may have, how many books you may have written. This was a set fire. We had a jury of 12 people that convicted a man who was later executed. Was Mr. Willingham innocent? In my opinion, he was guilty as the day he was born.
So that was Corsicana arson investigator Douglas Fogg, who has not changed his original opinion. What did you learn about the way that fire investigators in Corsicana at the time that the Willingham children were killed in 1991, what kind of training did arson investigators have?
It was mostly on-the-job training. And so basically they would go out with their superiors and learn on the job and learn in the field. And, you know, that definitely has value. However, if you're trying to call things forensic evidence, then there needs to be a little bit more science involved. And that's kind of what's been happening over the years. And again, especially in the 90s, is that people are actually doing proper testing. And the problem with being field evidence is that a lot of it is and was based on feel. And I think certain fields may be better for that than others. And I think the science of arson investigation, again, I think the more that it properly resembles a science, the better for the average citizen whoever faces an arson investigation.
There is something that scientists understand better today than they once did called a flashover. Can you explain what that is and how it might have affected the Willingham home the night that the fire broke out?
Sure. Flashover is the point at which the fire explodes and there's no going back, right? The thing is, the Willingham home, as you'll see in the movie, is a tiny, tiny cracker box of a home. And so I think that one of the things that that the public jury was resentful or felt that Todd Willingham didn't do correctly is he got out of the home before flashover occurred, right? So he, his story is he woke up, his little girl woke him up, and he crying, daddy, daddy, and he gets out and he's distraught and he says he breaks a window, and he may have broken a window, but they say you didn't go back in, and they say what was really damning there was the jury and the people of Corsicana felt that he should have been able to go in and rescue his children before flashover, because there was some time there before the house effectively exploded in fire, in big flames. But again, you don't know when everything's still incredibly hot. And the other thing that they said that the marks that he had on him, he came out with some very minor burn marks. They said that was not, they were not consistent with the story he told. And the thing is, like, much like Johnny Webb, Todd Willingham, he was a liar, you know, and he was a scared liar. And so it's very difficult to ascertain the truth then. And the fact that he was out before the flashover didn't bode well for him.
And what about this issue that came up at trial of accelerant that was discovered on the family's front porch, as if someone had sloshed something around?
Yeah, well, there was a can. There, it's pictured in one of the photos. There's a can of effectively gasoline, and you know there is no evidence that that was actually there. It was not found in the home, as initially was stated. And so in that case, people said, well, it could have just been the idea then is it was just there are a lot of barbecues and all that type of thing around, and it could have been. And again, in this environment that of the early 90s, you know, people had gasoline for – we don't have gasoline cans around quite as much, you know, in kind of urban areas. But in this kind of more rural situation, it wasn't at all unusual to have a gas can around for a multitude of reasons, you know, things running out of gas and – you know, lawnmowers, and a gas can would not have been really unusual on any property in Corsicana. I think.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, not knowing too much about the story, it does seem that being impoverished always seems to influence how one is perceived. One's credibility is hampered purely by their social status and bankroll. You think that was that played into this case, Jesse?
Well, I do not necessarily. I think there's a vicious cycle. I think that being impoverished in this case kind of fed into Mr. Willingham's problems, meaning that I think he was kind of a petty drug dealer in order to earn money and kind of couldn't get a job, had difficulty keeping a job. And so that kind of led to bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And it certainly hurt him when it came time for a trial. It certainly hurt him that his attorneys didn't have, you know, irrespective of how hard they tried, it always helps to have money, and then you can research, and you know, then you can get top rate, top notch arson investigators. You can just have more than one rather than just the states go with the states arson investigators. You know, they would have had more resources to them that he just didn't have. He was reliant on, he had to take what he got. There was no money to adequately defend himself. So it certainly didn't help. I think the cycle of poverty was not helpful in creating his cycle, but I'm not sure. Again, I think that Corsicana, like a lot of towns, has, you know, has fairly well-off people and people who have less means, and it feels like the community was quite close-knit, and they wanted, like, they would have supported, poverty wasn't the issue. I think there was a lot of support around that too, but I think that Willingham got himself kind of in a bad downward spiral around poverty.
My guest is producer Jesse Dieter. She directed the Frontline documentary Death by Fire 2 that airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll talk more with Jesse Dieter in a few minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is producer Jessie Dieter. She directed the Frontline documentary Death by Fire 2. It has just been updated with new information, and it airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join the conversation about the case of Cameron Todd Willingham, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we hear from David in Dallas. Hello, David.
Yes, hi, Chris. Excellent show. I love your show, and good luck on your fundraising event.
Thank you.
Yes, my question is as an electrical engineer, the technical aspects, because I follow the case somewhat, but I've never heard exactly why the arson. What are the one side the experts saying? Why did the fire start this way? And what are the other experts saying? Why the fire? Again, the technical aspects of what the conflicting opinions are.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. And I think the other part of flashover that I didn't quite get to is one of the main things that we're seeing as a real mark of evidence of an arson, of a set fire, were these pore patterns, what people used to perceive as pore patterns on the floor. And it turns out that that's what happens. Those are patterns. Those are actually ventilation patterns caused by the location of windows when flashover occurs, this big whoosh and the way the air moves. And so that was one of the, that was another scientific, in quotes, indicator of an arson. And I would say that those are, there are all these kind of things. And the thing was, one of the things that, was so difficult and is still difficult for the fire investigators from the original case today is that they say, yes, but we looked for how the fire could have started. They did exactly what you're talking about. They traced the electrical because there was a Christmas tree up in this little tiny house, and they looked at the toaster, and we have video of them going through and kind of diligently going and tracing the wires to see if they could find evidence of an electrical fire. They were looking for, of course, they were looking for possible accidental causes as well. And the fact that they couldn't find, a very obvious accidental cause either was, I think, seen it to them in those eyes as evidence of arson at the time.
It is important to note that there aren't allegations that the arson investigators, the original arson investigators in Corsicana, were setting out to frame Cameron Todd Willingham, that they were, to their knowledge, doing a thorough job of investigating the scene. They may have arrived at conclusions that later investigators disagreed with, but am I correct about that?
That's correct. I don't believe that anybody investigating this case from the arson investigators, and I've talked to several of them, to Jimmy Hensley, the police investigator, to even John Jackson, the prosecutor. I think that they all set out with the best of intentions. I don't believe that anybody overtly, consciously tried to frame Todd Willingham. I just think that they had quite a few preconceptions that they and prejudices that they perhaps weren't even aware of, that then when they found what they thought was evidence that kind of fit their preconceptions, then it just made it that much more easy to believe.
Did the subsequent investigators, were they just relying on photographs and notes taken? They weren't able to walk through the scene itself. Is that correct?
That is correct. They mm-hmm. were well. We have pretty good video as well. I mean, the initial fire investigators, to their credit, there were quite a few photographs, quite a bit of video that they kind of narrated through what they saw, and they did a pretty good job of documenting what they saw. And they also have, we have the samples from the floors that were pulled, so they do have a fair amount of evidence. And then the fire investigators will say, yes, the initial fire investigators will say, yes, but you weren't there and you don't know what I saw and you don't know what I felt.
Jesse, one thing that I think makes this case so fascinating and yet so vexing at the same time is that if, in fact, Cameron Todd Willingham was wrongly convicted of murder, we would consider that definitely a gross miscarriage of justice. And yet, nothing changes the fact that he is an imperfect protagonist in this story, right? He's not an easy guy to like, even if he was wrongly convicted.
That's true, which is one of the reasons I like him, which is one of the reasons I think he's a great protagonist, because I think that much like the movie that came out a long time ago called Dead Man Walking, Sean Penn's character, who was on death row, was not a very likable protagonist either. But I believe that if we truly believe in our system, then we must offer the same protections and laws to everybody, whether or not that is completely immaterial. And we should be able to trust the system even more because it protects people we don't like, you know, as much as it protects heroes and people we think are very sympathetic characters. And there's a lot that I was unable to show our audience as well, because I spent a lot of time working on this and I have letters. I feel as if I know Todd Willingham much more than, you know, than our audience has, because we couldn't get everything into the film. But he was loved. He was very beloved by a host of people. And there are people who saw him with his children and thought he really loved them. And, you know, not just his mother. He definitely had people on his side as well. We just couldn't access that in the film. We wanted the viewers to see what the jury at the time saw. We wanted to kind of give Willingham a new trial with the addition of kind of the new evidence, the new forensic evidence, and kind of this new evidence about the testimony of Johnny Webb, the jailhouse snitch.
And as is raised in the film, you know, no Texas politician is helping his or her career by appearing soft on crime. So that might have been part of the calculus of Governor Perry in considering this evidence.
Well, I had a spectacular interview with Michael Hall, one of our journalists in the film, and he said, I said, gosh, you know, how do you think Texas or Texans would feel or react if they thought that, you know, we'd actually executed an innocent man? And Michael Hall said to me, you know, down here in Texas, they think 90% is an A. Like one innocent man, you know, it's and
I'm
again,
sure that's
this
not
is,
universal.
That was said in jest. Yes, that right, was completely right, right. said in jest. And I've spoken to many Texans who would not feel that way. However, I do believe I have met a contingent, and not just Texas, Californians. I mean, there are people say, well, that would never be me. They don't believe it would ever be them or their family or their loved ones. So that's okay. And I think, you know, objectively speaking, regardless of how you feel about certain characters, I think we need to be able to trust in our justice system as much as possible.
Do you think if Cameron Todd Willingham had been sentenced to life in prison without parole, but he was alive, do you think that people would have come back to the case over and over? Or was there something about the fact that he was for a while in jeopardy of being executed and then ultimately was executed that has made this seem more urgent for people who are continuing to pay attention to this?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it. But I do know that, you know, the innocence projects around the country and, you know, and arson projects, there are many people working, many good people doing a lot of pro bono work to get out people who sit in prisons today who have been wrongly convicted. And so, you know, those cases are certainly not as high profile. They're not as dramatic. But, you know, the Marshall Project's Maurice Postley, who's featured in our update, is working on a database of exonerations, and I think he's pushing 2,000 exonerations. He's collecting their stories, right? And so, you know, it's obviously an imperfect system, but I think that the extent to which we can learn lessons from these things is it's important to actually learn them and make changes.
Producer Jesse Dieter directed the Frontline documentary Death by Fire 2. You can see the updated program when it airs tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. Jesse, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening. We also want to give special thanks to Mashal Noor, who helped us out on the phones today.